Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone who's joining us here at Happy Hour with Dr. T. We get together each week, Tuesday night, which is guest night, with amazing guests and have inspirational conversations that I know you will enjoy hearing because I enjoy hearing them, and we get great feedback from our discussions. On Thursday night, generally over the last couple of years, it's been my night to lead Happy Hour with Dr. T, usually as a Bible study, but we've decided to switch things up a little bit, and we've been having these incredible discussions with authors and bringing forth things that are just amazing. And tonight is our fourth part of this special event called The Second Coming of Saturn. This four-part series is a deep dive into the supernatural enemy that has plagued humanity since the beginning of time. Now, if by some chance you miss part one or two or three, they are available for free at drtenpenny.com/Saturn. You can go directly to the page and you can see the little asset that's put there and you can get the link. And so you don't have to miss any of these, and they will be free and available up there through the end of February. So be sure and share this information with your friends and family members because you really, really won't want to miss it. Part one was about the rebellion of the Watchers. Part two, Derek explained why Lucifer is not Saturn. These are two different entities, and he makes a very compelling argument for that using biblical texts and other assorted documents. Last week in part three, we talked about the detestable pagan god in the Bible, Moloch, which in the Hebrew nickname is the Canaanite god El, also known as Saturn, who also has a bunch of other names that we talked about. And after we got off of the line last week and Derek and I were talking, I said, "You're so smart. How did you put all this stuff together? This is just so amazing." And we talked about the evidence that tied the Mount of Olives to a link to the U.S. Capitol building and even George Washington. I mean, it's just an amazing series of information. If you listened to it last week live, you want to be sure and go and listen to it again. And hopefully that you have gotten the book by now to follow along with it, to get Derek's book, The Second Coming of Saturn, that you can get at gilberthouse.org. And they even said that if you buy it directly from them, that they will sign it. So that's something that you definitely want to have. There's so much more information. And remember, even though we're doing this four-part series, this is just the cliff notes of all the information that is definitely, definitely in these books. So with that, Derek, I want to just jump right in and go ahead, because I know we've got a little bit of time constraints, and you've got an enormous amount of information that you want to put forth for us here tonight in part four of this incredible series on the second coming of Saturn.
Well, thank you, Dr. T. It's it's an honor to be here, and I appreciate this opportunity just to share this research and this information because we find this so fascinating, but also because this, I think, connects a bunch of dots that for me had not been connected previously. And that's not to pat myself on the back, because I'm not the one who's actually reading the original Canaanite or Akkadian or Greek or Rome, you know, Latin, but just trying to step back and fit all these pieces together. You know, God bless the archaeologists who go out into the field and dig these things out of the ground, and the epigraphers and the linguists who are able to translate these texts, because that's not my gift. But just being able to try to fit these pieces together. And as you say in the book, The Second Coming of Saturn, I think I've got like 550 footnotes. Ooh. And a lot of them are to Bible references, Bible scriptures. But a lot of them are to these academic papers that these scholars have put together. So when you say, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, that's exactly where I'm at in trying to take the work of these scholars and just see what picture emerges when you put all these pieces together. But more than that, is why is it relevant to us as Christians today? I mean, this Yes. isn't just, I mean, I'm a history nerd. I love history. But if it's not relevant to us today, it's nothing more than an academic exercise. And so when people, you know, ask me about this stuff, why do you spend so much time on this stuff? You know, the cult of Molech and the cult of Kronos and Saturn and the child sacrifice in the ancient world. Why shouldn't we just be talking about Jesus? And I agree. This is an aspect of talking about Jesus, because when we look at his ministry and where he focused his time and his attention and where he did certain things, as we discussed last week, with all of the attention that he paid to the Mount of Olives, where Solomon built a high place, a temple for Molech, 900 years before Jesus was born. And the fact that Jesus spent the last week of his life dividing his time between the Mount of Olives and the Temple Mount, And we'll talk about the Temple Mount this week and why that's so important. Why did Jesus spend so much time on the Mount of Olives? If the Temple Mount was where his father's house was located, which is what he called the Temple of Herod, why wasn't he there the whole time, every waking moment, the last week of his life? Because there's something significant about the Mount of Olives and about the entity who had claimed that high place for his own and convinced Solomon to build a temple there.
You know, what pulls this though together for me, Derek, is that, and I think I may have even mentioned this to you in one of our other, either talking offline or, you know, one of our other sessions. In September of this last year, I went to a meeting that was at the Bible Museum in Washington, D.C. And I remember when we were getting tours of the museum interspersed with the meeting that we were actually there to attend. And I remember asking one of the tour guides, I mean, why Israel? I mean, you know, I mean, Israel's an okay place, but it's a desert and there are a lot more beautiful places on the planet, quite frankly. And he right. got kind of huffy with me and he said, well, have you ever been there? And I said, well, I've been to Jordan, but I've not been to Israel. And they're kind of like look the same. And I've been to Petra. And so I kind of know what the area looks like. And he's like, well, it's a beautiful place. Well, that he missed the point. I mean, yeah, everything that you've been talking about, it's because the falling angels, the watchers that came down, that, you know, that did all the stuff that they did, it was there that he had to come and conquer and overcome for humanity. I mean, it would have been great if he would have come down and landed in like Norway or someplace beautiful like that, right? But what, you know, and that's not to denigrate Norway at all, but it wasn't the spiritual point of the exercise.
Right.
So these lessons and these things that we've been talking about here just brings the whole Bible to life for me and brings it to me. And I'm sure our listeners are feeling the same about the purpose of why there. I think that's really important.
Right. Yeah. And that's a good question. Sharon and I have discussed that too, because when you look at Israel, for the most part, when you get south of the Jezreel Valley, which is, you know, Mount Carmel, Megiddo, over to Beth Shean, when you get south of there towards Jerusalem, and especially south of Jerusalem, you get into the Judean desert and the Negev, and you're right, it's really, really dry. Now, up further north near Dan at the base of Mount Hermon or Caesarea Philippi, ancient Caesarea Philippi, that area is very green and very lush. They do get quite a bit of rainfall. The Jezreel Valley, when you look at it from Mount Carmel or Megiddo, it looks like the American Midwest, you know, these really neat, orderly farms where they're growing all kinds of crops. It was the breadbasket of ancient Israel, and it still is to this day. But why there? Why did these watchers, according to the book of First Enoch, why did they descend on Mount Hermon? If it was just because it's a tall mountain, well, yeah, it's 9,200 feet. But when you look at the list of tall mountains on planet Earth, it's not even in the top 100.
Oh, wow.
Why, if you're looking for a really tall mountain, why not the Himalayas? You know, why not Kilimanjaro? Why not, you know, someplace in the Rockies? And if you're looking for a place that's beautiful, no disrespect to the guide at the Bible Museum, but why not the American Midwest? I mean, this is lush and green and, you know, you grow crops all over the place and you got wildlife. I mean, back in the 19th century, before we killed off the bison, you had, you know, meat on the hoof, and, you know, plenty of water. It's not like Israel, where, again, when you're south of Jerusalem, you really got to protect your water supplies in order to make things grow. And yet that was the land that God said to Abraham, your descendants will take possession of this land. And the 12 tribes, when they came back 400 years later, had to divide up that land. So why?
Well, even honestly, even the Tigris and Euphrates, you know, where Ur, right. where Abraham came out of, was much more beautiful and lush than Israel. But this whole spiritual connection of all these things is just, it just brings it all to life. It's really great.
Well, actually, now I argue in the book, The Second Coming of Saturn, that Abraham came from southern Turkey. Yeah, it was just a generic term in the ancient Mesopotamian languages that just meant city. And there are a number of Ur's around. And there's a long tradition in Turkey that the city of Sanliurfa was Abraham's hometown. I suggest it might even have been Urkesh, which is that city of the ancient Hurrians in what is now northern Syria, just across the border with Turkey, that might have been Abraham's hometown. But when you look at the clues in the Bible, there's biblical evidence for this idea, because Jacob was, as Joshua was retelling the history of the Israelites, He said, you know, our fathers came from the land beyond the river, meaning beyond the Euphrates. Well, Ur in Iraq, in ancient Sumer, is on the west side of the Euphrates River, whereas the cities in southern Turkey now, Haran, which is where Abraham came from after he came from the city called Ur, that's east of the Euphrates. So it's more likely that Abraham came from there when he sent Jacob, you know, when he sent his servant back to get a bride for Isaac, rather not Jacob, but Isaac. They went to northern Mesopotamia. They didn't go to Sumer. So
but interesting.
The lifestyle of Abraham as a traveling merchant and herder was much more like the Amorite lifestyle than the Sumerian city dwelling lifestyle. You know, spiritually speaking, doesn't really matter, but I think historically it's interesting, especially given the historic clues that point to the origin of this entity, or at least the origin of the cult of this entity called Saturn, Kronos, Kumarbi by the ancient Hurrians, from being that very place where Abraham came from, that same part of Turkey. In fact, we're trying to put together a tour of Turkey later this year where we would go to San Lanurfa.
You'll have to kill me, but because I've been to Turkey, and it was a long time ago. It was 1994, and I've been blessed to have been in a lot of countries around the world. And to this day, when people ask me what is my favorite country, I always say Turkey.
Yeah,
it's beautiful there. The food, the culture, the history. Oh, the history there that goes back to the Hittites and all that. It's just fascinating. So keep me posted. I might be an early sign up for that one if you get that ready there. That would be great.
We're hoping to get a couple of archaeologists, including a guest who's been on your program, Dr. Judd Burton, to come with us.
Fascinating.
And, Dr. Aaron Judkins have done some research and writing about Göbekli Tepe and the influence of the Watchers on Göbekli Tepe. So that's one of the reasons for putting this tour together. But the influence of this entity, Saturn, Kronos, Kumarbi, Shemiyaza of the Book of First Enoch, on the world today, this cult of this old entity continues down to the present day. In fact, there was a cult, a secret society, if you will, or an esoteric society founded in 1927 in Germany by a fellow named Eugene Grosch. This is called the Fraternitas Saturni, the Brotherhood of Saturn. Describes itself as a purely esoteric lodge of knowledge that seeks to realize the impulse of the Aquarius age of spiritual clarity and freedom. In our first week, we talked about the great conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn on the winter solstice of 2020, when Jupiter and Saturn met at 0 degrees of the constellation Aquarius. This was sort of a handing of the baton from the ruler of the Roman pantheon, Jupiter, the storm god, Baal of the Bible, who Jesus referred to as Satan in Matthew 12 and Revelation 2, back to Saturn, the old god, the return of Saturn's reign, the return of the golden age. Why is this relevant? Because Aquarius, the constellation, according to astrologers, is ruled by the planet Saturn. So this, astrologically speaking, or from an occult perspective, was a very important date. We are now officially fully into the age of Aquarius. Well, this secret society founded in Germany, 1927, they're dedicated to pursuing esoteric knowledge, the point being to self-actualize through the pursuit of secret knowledge. Others have described this group, the Brotherhood of Saturn, as a unique blend of Scottish Freemasonry, Luciferianism, astrological mythology, and Indian yoga systems, with an emphasis placed on the unique power that its adherents believed could be drawn from the dark side of Saturn.
Wow.
Now, most of us in the English-speaking world haven't heard of the Fraternitas Saturnae because all of their writings are in German. So if you don't speak or read German, you're not going to be able to understand what they've been writing. But according to experts on secret societies, the Brotherhood of Saturn is not only the most important secret magical lodge of 20th century Germany, and bear in mind that the Nazis were essentially a cult more than a political party, but one of the most important secret societies of the 20th century, of the whole world, the magical lodges. The volume of the texts that they've produced, occult texts, is greater than anything else other than the lodges or societies that were connected to Aleister Crowley, who founded the Ordo Templi Orientis, the OTO, and the Argentum Astrum. And, of course, they've got branches all over the world. But other than Aleister Crowley and the magical systems that he inspired, the Brotherhood of Saturn is the most influential and has published more material than any other group. The central feature of their magical system is a concept called the egregore. The egregore. This is a thought creature. It's a theosophist concept. Theosophy was the magical system, the occult religion founded by Helena Blavatsky in the 19th century. This is an idea through which a person or a group, by focusing their thoughts and prayers and will, can create a sort of imaginary friend, for lack of a better term, a thought creature that becomes sentient and autonomous. There's a term for it in the Hindu religion, but the Brotherhood of Saturn calls it an egregore. But that term derives from the Greek word egregore, which means watcher.
Wow.
In the sense of the watchers who were those sons of God who rebelled in Genesis chapter 6, the watchers. This has inspired a number of other movements around the world through its writings. Here in the 21st century in the United States, another group that venerates Saturn calls itself the Order of Nine Angles. The Order of Nine Angles. This was founded in the 1980s based on a set of neo-Nazi beliefs. And again, the Nazis coming out of the 20th century, about the same time that Grosch was forming the Brotherhood of Saturn. It's built around this idea called the Tree of Word, W-Y-R-D, which is a modified tree of life from the mystical Jewish religious system called the Kabbalah. It modifies this tree of life so that there are only seven nodes in this tree as opposed to 10. But at the top of the tree is the Norse Allfather, Odin, which is essentially just the Norse version of Saturn. Again, this old god who's been banished or he's in the netherworld, but he's coming back. This group, the Order of Nine Angles, considers itself authentically satanic, unlike some of the other groups out there that get more press, like, the Satanic Temple, which just announced, as we're recording this, they've announced their second annual conference, SatanCon, coming to Boston this summer, this spring, rather. The Satanic Temple is essentially just a political movement founded by a guy who's trying to use the United States Constitution to push Christianity out of the public square. The Order of Nine Angles considers guys like the Satanic Temple play actors. They are cosplay Satanists, whereas the Order of Nine Angles believes they are legitimately satanic. Their goal is the destruction of Western civilization, which they believe, according to their writings, has been weakened by the teachings of the Magians, or Jews, drawn from the Magi, and the Nazarene influences, in other words, Christians. Jews and Christians have weakened Western civilization. They need to return it to something based around the Norse pantheon. What most of us know about the Norse pantheon comes from the Marvel movies. And look, the Norse gods were not wisecracking hipsters like Thor is depicted in the Marvel movies. They were pretty brutal. Odin was a pretty brutal deity to worship, very bloody. And these guys in the Order of Nine Angles believe that tactics like human sacrifice are legitimate tools for the destruction of Western civilization and the rebuilding along more authentically satanic lines. There's another character who has recently gone public with his worship of Enlil, and Enlil, again, is just one of the identities worn by this ancient entity. Enlil was his name for the Babylonians, the Akkadians, the Sumerians. This man is named Damien Eccles. If his name sounds familiar, you might remember the story of the West Memphis Three from back in 1993, 30 years ago. May 5th of 1993, 3 8-year-old boys went missing from West Memphis, Arkansas, and they were found a day later, victims of what police called a satanic ritual sex slaying. Eccles and two colleagues were convicted in 1994 of the killings. But in 2010, after documentaries produced by some rather well-connected people in Hollywood that were aired on HBO, Eccles and his colleagues, the West Memphis Three, were set loose. They were set free on what are called Alford pleas. That's a legal tactic that allows a defendant to plead guilty while not admitting any guilt, saying, I'm innocent, but I'm going to plead guilty. Anyway, they're out, they're free, and Eccles has made a new career as an occultist. And as our friend William Ramsey has shown in his research, it was pretty clear that Eccles was deep into his study of the teachings of Aleister Crowley before the slayings of those three boys in West Memphis, Arkansas in 1993. Support for Eccles came from some very high-profile people in Hollywood, including Winona Ryder, Peter Jackson, director of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, Johnny Depp, who is now a personal friend of Damien Eccles, Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam, Natalie Maines of the group formerly called the Dixie Chicks, now just the Chicks, because, you know, Dixie is, you can't say that word anymore. But William Ramsey has dug into this case, and when you read the book that he wrote about the West Memphis Three, just drawing from the trial transcripts, you can see there is a supernatural aspect to this, an occult aspect to those killings that the media has downplayed and that Hollywood has downplayed in generating sympathy for these boys who were depicted as the victims of bigoted, closed-minded, small-town people in Arkansas who didn't like Eccles and his colleagues because they listened to heavy metal and wore black t-shirts or whatever. Wow. So Eccles is now a sorcerer. He's got a Patreon page through which you can subscribe and learn magic. That's magic with a K, as it was spelled by Aleister Crowley. But he wrote in his book, Angels and Archangels, from just a couple of years ago, and I'm going to quote from the book now. One morning when I was in the middle of the angelic invocations involved in the Shem operation, I experienced something that was initially disorienting and frightening. Suddenly, it felt like the very earth dropped away beneath my feet. I was surrounded by an incredible amount of light. It was so bright that it felt like I was standing in the middle of the sun. Then it felt like something snapped, and I was surrounded by the darkness of an infinite void. The closest I'll ever be able to come to articulating what happened is this. I saw the nighttime sky. It was crystal clear, truly beautiful. And then across the vision of the sky, I saw a word spelled out just as if the wind were gently rippling across the stars, as if they were wheat. The word was Enlil. And so now he's concluded that when he summons angels, which is what his magical system does, he summons Enlil, who I remind you is this entity called Saturn, Kronos, Baal Haman, and so on. Because when he does, he feels, and I'm going to quote again, the unified power of 1,000 archangels, end quote. Now, I think Mr. Eccles is deceived. I don't think he's directly in contact with this entity because according to Peter and Jude, he's in the abyss, in chains, in gloomy darkness. But remember, he's got minions. He's got these demonic offspring that he and his colleagues created in the pre-flood era, who I believe are in contact with him and carrying out his will, preparing for his return. But don't be afraid, because God has already foreseen this, and we know how long he gets when old Saturn comes to return to the throne, and it's not very long. And the odds are, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, if you've accepted him as your Lord and Savior, you're not going to be here when he gets here anyway. Anyway, when will this all take place? I believe this is all connected to the final battle of the ages that we call Armageddon. And you know, I mentioned when we discussed our Israel tour that contrary to popular belief, contrary to the Israel National Park system, Armageddon will not be fought at Megiddo. There's a similarity in the words Megiddo and the Hebrew phrase Har Megiddon, which means Mount of Megiddo, which is what is translated, or what English speakers believed the word Armageddon is based on, but that is not the case. And I have great respect for those who have taught this, including people that we respect a great deal. Chuck Missler, Dwight Pentecost, John Wolvard, Arnold Fruchtenbaum have all taught that Megiddo, which was the site of some key battles throughout history, one in World War I, in the ancient world, the good king Josiah was killed in a battle at Megiddo against the Egyptians. He was trying to stop them from going north to help the Assyrians fight off the Babylonians. But there is no mountain at Megiddo. there is a hill there that it's called a tell, which is because in the ancient world, when your city was destroyed by an earthquake or invaders, you'd kind of level off the rubble and build on top of the rubble. So over time, you'd build up this little hill. But there's no mountain at Megiddo. The term is Har Moed, Har Moed, which comes from Isaiah chapter 14. It means Mount of Assembly. And this is in reference to that verse in Isaiah 14 where Hillel ben Shachar, or light bringer, son of dawn, Lucifer, son of morning, wants to build his Mount of Assembly, his Har Moed, in the uttermost north, the heights of the north. It is a concept where in the ancient world, it was understood that the gods would meet at a mountain. The temple of Enlil, this entity we're discussing here, was called the House of the Mountain in the ancient Sumerian city of Nippur. The gods of Mesopotamia would meet there once a year to decree the fates of the land. Well, God, Yahweh, the God of the Bible, has a Har Moed, Mount of Assembly. It is Zion, the Temple Mount in Israel, in Jerusalem. And because John the Revelator, John the Apostle, when he was writing Revelation, had to translate from Hebrew into Greek, in the word Moed, in the middle of that word, you get a character that looks like a reverse apostrophe. It's called an ayin. There is no corresponding sound or letter in either Greek or English. It's a glottal stop. You know, Moed, that little stop in between the two syllables is the ayin. So John took the Hebrew letter closest to the glottal stop, which is gamma, and wrote Har Megiddon into Greek.
Oh, so English, wow.
English speakers, this was deciphered by a Harvard scholar by the name of Charles Torrey back around 1934, a Harvard Theological Review. So again, this is not Derek Gilbert trying to come up with some new weird way to interpret the Bible. Charles Torrey wrote, so that when English speakers went back to re-engineer, you know, reverse engineer the Hebrew from the Greek, it was assumed that the Greek letter gamel must have been the Hebrew letter gimel, which is the English letter G, G, instead of looking back and seeing if there were other places in the Bible where they could find that term, Mount of Assembly, Har Moed, from Isaiah 14. And he said, this is what it's all about. This final battle is for control of God's Mount of Assembly, where the divine council, God and his court, would meet. And that's where John gets the term Armageddon, Har Moed. This is consistent with other Old Testament prophecies that the whole world is going to come against Israel, and specifically at Jerusalem. Joel chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, Zechariah 12, verses 1 through 3, verse 9, Zechariah 14, verses 2 through 5. I mean, in Zechariah 14, as we mentioned last week, when the Messiah returns, when Jesus returns for that final battle, he lands at the Mount of Olives. Why would he do that if the battle was being fought at Megiddo 50 miles away? No, it's because the battle is for the control of the Temple Mount, God's Mount of Assembly, his Har Moed. This is what this is all about. So the scenario here, if we're looking at this final battle where this enemy, this entity, finally returns to earth from the netherworld, we'll see a situation where this enemy comes from the north. We see this in Ezekiel 38, Ezekiel 39, the War of Gog and Magog, the uttermost north. This is also mentioned in Isaiah chapter 14, the reference to the Mount of Assembly in the uttermost north. This is often used by respected prophecy teachers to point to Russia as the place where this enemy will come to do battle against Israel. I respectfully disagree. The phrase in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is Yarkatei Tzefon. I had to ask our tour guide in Israel last time we were there, how do you pronounce this, Yeshai? It's okay. Yarkatei Tzefon. Well, that means uttermost north. Now, Tzefon was the mountain that was sacred to Baal in the ancient world. We know where it's located. Today, it's called Jebel al-Akra. It's in Turkey, just across the border from Syria. It's on the Mediterranean coast, very close to ancient Antioch. But I think that's the key to understanding this here. When we're talking about north, we're not talking about geographic north. which if you're looking at that and looking at a map, draw a line north for Jerusalem, the uttermostest north you can get is Russia. So that makes sense. But when you're looking at this as a supernatural conflict, which is, after all, what this is, you look at cosmic north, supernatural north, Yarkatay Tzafon, the mountain sacred to Baal, who, I repeat, is identified as Satan by Jesus in Matthew 12 and in Revelation chapter 2, the letter to the church of Pergamum. I know where you live, where Satan dwells. That's a reference to the great altar of Zeus. Zeus, the storm god, just the Greek version of Baal. In fact, the word Tzafon in Hebrew is kind of unique amongst Semitic languages, because the word that means north in other ancient Semitic languages like Canaanite, Eblaite, Akkadian is Simal. Simal, not Tzafon. Why Tzafon means north in Hebrew? It's because that's where Baal's mountain is located. And Baal was so important to the pagans around ancient Israel that it became the word for the compass point north. Unlike the related languages, where again, the compass point north is the word Simal. And again, I've got this documented. Scholars, I'm not going to go out and speculate on this and say, I think this makes sense. If I can't find a scholarly support for this, I'm not going to state this as fact, but this is documented. This is where the enemy will come from. This is the rallying point. This mountain that was sacred to Baal is the rallying point for the forces of the Antichrist. Gog of Magog in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is essentially the Antichrist. He is the Old Testament concept of the Antichrist. When he names these entities or these other nations that will join with the coalition, Ezekiel is essentially pointing to an enemy coming from the north. And then he points to Persia, which is Iran, Kush, which is in the south, that would be Ethiopia and or Sudan, and Put, which is Libya in the west. Now, frankly, Sudan and Libya are not really even functioning nation states at this point. But in the 6th century BC, when Ezekiel wrote his book, they were essentially the places that were the farthest in those directions, you know, Iran, Ethiopia, Libya, that his readers would have been familiar with. And when you look at it on a map, what Ezekiel has essentially said here is that this army of Gog of Magog, led by Gog of Magog, is coming from all four compass points, north, south, east, west. The whole world is coming to do battle at Jerusalem, Israel generally, Jerusalem specifically. And as I mentioned earlier, these other verses, that's consistent with the apocalyptic prophecies of Joel and Zechariah. The whole world is coming against Israel. In Revelation 12, beginning at verse 17, going through Revelation 13, verse 1, we see the emergence of the Antichrist. The sea in the Old Testament, from which the seven-headed beast emerges, represents chaos. It is a representation of the abyss. This is where this entity comes from. Leviathan, the biblical entity that embodies chaos, like other depictions in the ancient Near East of primordial chaos. Tiamat, for example, the primordial chaos dragon. Yam in the Canaanite pantheon. Typhon for the Greeks. Apophis for the Egyptians. It's a similar story. Ilyanka in the Hittite and Hurrian pantheon. This was a primordial chaos dragon or monster that had to be subdued by a warrior god. And of course, in the Bible, we're talking about Leviathan and it being subdued by God, the God of the Bible. We believe that this is the spirit that embodies or indwells the human that we will call Antichrist. The representation of this seven-headed creature in Revelation 13, verse 1, doesn't sound like a dragon the way it's described in Revelation 13. But when you look at the artwork, the iconography in ancient Mesopotamia, this is exactly how dragons were depicted, and specifically dragons with seven heads. In Revelation, it's depicted as having a body like a leopard, feet like a bear's, mouth like a lion's mouth. But when you look at some of the inscriptions, the carvings, the artwork in ancient Mesopotamia, to them, that's what a dragon looked like. Didn't look like Smaug from, you know, Lord of the Rings. The Akkadian, and this is really interesting, the Akkadian name for this multi-headed dragon is Bashmu. Bashmu is a cognate, which means the same word but in a different language, for Bashan, which was the name of the kingdom ruled by Og of Bashan, who Moses and the Israelites went and did battle with before they crossed over the River Jordan to attack the city of Jericho. This gets back to that discussion we had about Bashan being considered an evil place, literally the entrance to the netherworld. Not only that, it was named for this seven-headed chaos monster that had to be subdued so that the world could be created for humanity to live in it. That's what we believe is happening when this spirit emerges from the sea, the spirit that's called the beast, the Antichrist. That's the spirit that indwells the human, who we will call the Antichrist. And then we get to the emergence of these creatures from the abyss. This is in Revelation 9, which I know is before Revelation 13. Revelation is not a linear sequence of events. It's non-linear storytelling, like many of the movies and stories on television these days. This is where this entity and his colleagues who rebelled in the days of Noah will emerge. In Revelation 9, we read that the fifth angel blows his trumpet, and John writes, "I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions on the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were allowed to torment them for 5 months, but not to kill them. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. In appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold." Whoop, I skipped ahead. Scorpion when it stings someone. This is an important verse, especially given the World Economic Forum's Great Reset and its Fourth Industrial Revolution, which is transhumanism, the idea that we'll overcome death through technology. Revelation 9, "In those days, people will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them." And then it goes on to describe the locust and so forth. Now, these don't sound like the titans of Greek mythology, but by the time the Greeks were writing their religion down in the 6th, 7th century BC, these things have been off the earth for thousands of years. So the Greeks were, you know, creating from their imaginations to some degree. And also they were being whispered to by these spirits of the demons who were the children of these entities. Oh yeah, they looked like you, totally. But the ancient Mesopotamians, in their depiction of these spirits called the Apkallu, they were depicted as theriomorphic, which is part human, part animal.
Wow.
And the scholar Amar Anus, who I've mentioned several times now, showed that the Apkallu of the Mesopotamians were the watchers of the Hebrews. And again, because of the connection to Tartarus, I believe that they are also these sons of God from Genesis 6, who Peter and Jude say are locked away in the bottomless pit, chained in gloomy darkness. And again, Peter specifically uses the word Tartarosis, thrust down to Tartarus. So that's who we're looking at here. And this is why I believe, and another bit of evidence from this passage in Revelation 9, why I believe we can equate the sons of God from Genesis 6 and their children destroyed in the flood of Noah to the Greek titans who are locked away in the abyss. The connection between the sinful angels mentioned by Jude and Peter and the sons of God in the days of Noah. Notice that when they are allowed out of the abyss, they are given power to torment humanity, those without the seal of God on their foreheads, for 5 months. And last week I mentioned Noah's ark on the water while these entities were locked away, chained up, watching their children die in the flood of Noah. In Genesis 7 and Genesis 8, twice it's mentioned that the ark of Noah was on the water for exactly 150 days. We see a lot of numbers in the Bible that have significance, symbolic significance, like the number 70, which means all of them, the complete set, not one left out. the number 40, the number 10, the number 100, you know, 100, thousands and so forth, the number 3, the number 7. 150 is unique. And we see it echoed here in Revelation chapter 9. 5 months in a lunar calendar of 30-day months is exactly 150 days. It bookends the destruction of the Nephilim in the flood of Noah in Genesis 7 and 8, 150 days. At the end, the spirits who created those hybrid giants, given 5 months exactly to torment the rebellious humans on earth who have not accepted the seal of God on their forehead by accepting Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. I think this is the clue that identifies them as one and the same. The creatures in the abyss with the sons of God from Genesis 6. And again, the connection to the old gods of all of the cultures in the ancient Near East, the Romans, the Greeks, the Hurrians, the Hittites, the Mesopotamians, their old gods, their former gods who are now in the netherworld, I think are one and the same with those sons of God from Genesis chapter 6. This, the king over those in the abyss, the king over those in the bottomless pit, I believe, is the one the Greeks and the Romans called the king of the Titans, the one who formerly ruled before the rise of the storm god, Zeus, Jupiter, Baal, Tesheb, Marduk. I think that's who we're talking about here. Shemiyaza is the destroyer, Abaddon, Apollyon, who is the king over those in the bottomless pit. And remember, the Mount of Olives, where the temple for Molech was constructed by Solomon 900 years before the birth of Jesus, called the Mount of the Destroyer by the priests, because it looked down on the temple of God. I think that's who we're dealing with here. This entity who led the rebellion in the beginning on Mount Hermon, corrupted the human bloodline by commingling with human women, is the one who is now the king over those in the abyss, known to the Greeks and Romans as the king of the Titans. He will lead this army out of the abyss in the end times, but he'll only get 5 months to torment humanity. Now, what happens to them specifically, Revelation doesn't say. My guess is that this ends, his 5 months ends with Armageddon and the destruction of the rebellious army at Armageddon. Remember again the terms Abaddon and Apollyon in Revelation chapter 9. In Hebrew and Greek, mean destroyer, which points back to the Mount of Olives. And we've got this connection between the Mount of Olives and Jesus spending so much time there the final week of his life, but also returning there to put an end to this at the Battle of Armageddon. When he returns in Zechariah 14, he lands on the Mount of Olives and splits it in half, the north half and the south half, splitting in half. I believe that's what creates the Valley of Jehoshaphat, which is where God will judge the nations, leading to the eastern gate through which the Messiah will enter the Temple Mount. There are a number of references in the Old Testament to Abaddon. This is the first time I've done a study on this. And in my view, Abaddon, when you look at the dictionary of deities and demons in the Bible, they're kind of inconclusive as to whether this was an actual entity. I believe that Abaddon is the equivalent, the Hebrew equivalent of Tartarus, and Sheol, there, which we see mentioned in the Old Testament a number of times. The Hebrew concept of the netherworld is the equivalent of Hades. We see it in a number of parallel scriptures in the Old Testament where Sheol, for example, Job 26:6, Sheol is naked before God and Abaddon has no covering. So I think it's a parallelism equivalent to Hades and Tartarus in the Greek mind. Some may ask, how is it possible that Abaddon can be a place, or, you know, if it's equivalent to Tartarus, how can it be a place but also an entity? How could it be, you know, this place in the netherworld but also a this entity called the Destroyer? But remember, in Greek mythology, Greek religion, Hades was the god of the dead, but it was also the place in the underworld where the dead went. So it would not be unique to the Hebrews if Abaddon represented both this entity called the Destroyer and also the place in the netherworld reserved for those supernatural threats to the order created by God. So I go into that. It's word study, and it's hard to go through verbally here. This is where one place where the book will be really useful, because I dig deep into that, into the second coming of Saturn. Interestingly, I think the spirits of the giants destroyed in the flood also have a role to play in the end times. And just to remind your viewers, the spirits of those giants destroyed in the flood of Noah were believed by the early church to be demons. And I have no reason to disagree with that theory. That was the consensus view of the early church theologians for the first four centuries after the resurrection. It wasn't until Augustine in the early fifth century that the idea that the Nephilim or the giants mentioned in Genesis chapter 6 were actually just the product of the righteous sons of Seth, you know, the sons of God, and the evil daughters of Cain. You know, the Sethite theory is now what is taught. That's a sort of the default view of Christian theologians. That's what's taught to our pastors in seminary today. So if your pastor doesn't believe this, it's probably because that's just what he was taught. But it's not what the early church believed. Early church theologians were unified in this. It was, you know, wasn't even really questioned until about the year 400 AD. Anyway, in Ezekiel 38 and 39, he describes the end of the war that we believe ends at Armageddon, the end of the war of Gog and Magog. In Ezekiel 39, verse 7, and this is why one of the reasons that Sharon and I have concluded the war of Gog and Magog ends with Armageddon. Verse 7 of Ezekiel 39, and my holy name, this is God speaking, my holy name I will make known in the midst of my people Israel, and I will not let my holy name be profaned anymore, and the nations shall know that I am Yahweh, the Holy One in Israel. Note, Holy One in Israel. You see the phrase, the Holy One of Israel, multiple times in the Old Testament. This is the only place where you see the Holy One in Israel, and it's because he's on the battlefield, and that occurs at the last battle when the Messiah returns and he takes the field against the forces of Antichrist, the forces of Gog, of Magog. And this is confirmed by a rather gruesome feast of the dead that Ezekiel describes in Ezekiel 39, verses 17 through 20. The same feast is described by John in Revelation 19, verses 17 and 18, where these the rebellious army is laid out as a feast for the birds of every sort and all beasts of the field, according to Ezekiel. And in that passage in Ezekiel 39, he makes reference to the flesh of the mighty, the Gibberim, and the princes of the earth, of rams, of lambs, and of he-goats, of bulls, all of them fat beasts of Bashan. That reference to Bashan, again, is sort of a clue that he's talking about supernatural entities connected to that cult of the dead that was centered on that region of Bashan. And again, it's clear, and I'm not the first one to think of this. This Bible commentators going back centuries have noted the parallel between Revelation 19 and Ezekiel 39. It's the same feast. The war of Gog and Magog concludes with Armageddon. But in Ezekiel 39, verse 11, he writes this, on that day, which is the day of the Lord, the day when God comes down and puts a stop to all of this, I will give to Gog a place for burial in Israel, the Valley of the Travelers east of the sea. It will block the travelers, for there Gog and all his multitude will be buried. The word travelers, usually Bible commentators will look at this and take the English understanding of the word, the English definition, and say, okay, well, there will be so many killed in this battle, east of the sea, east of the Dead Sea, that it will block the King's Highway, which was the main road from Egypt leading to Mesopotamia, up along the east side of the Dead Sea. Thing is, in the Dictionary of Deities and Demons in the Bible, there's an entry for the word travelers because the word was used by the ancient Canaanites, the Amorites, for the spirits of the Rephaim, the spirits of the Nephilim destroyed in the flood of Noah. The Canaanites knew who they were. They were called travelers in one of the Rephaim texts where they were described as being summoned through a necromancy ritual to the threshing floor of El, which would be the summit of Mount Hermon, where El, the Canaanite creator god, El, Saturn, Kronos, Molech, etc., held court with Asherah, his consort, and their 70 sons. And the Rephaim would mount their chariots, and they would travel first one day and then another and arrive at dawn of the third day, where a feast was prepared for the travelers, so-called because they traveled or crossed over from the land of the dead to the realm of the living. And Ezekiel puts this Valley of the Travelers in the vicinity of the plains of Moab, where Moses got his only look at the Holy Land. I mean, east of the Dead Sea, there aren't many areas there. It's really mountains rising out of the Dead Sea, except for the plains of Moab in the northeast corner. That's where Ezekiel puts the end of the war of Gog and Magog. And I think it's really interesting because that area there, the plains of Moab, is both where Moses was buried and also where Elijah left this earth. He crossed over from Jericho, and then the chariots of God caught him up and took him up to heaven. So you've got something supernaturally significant about that area between Mount Nebo, where Moses got his only look at the promised land, and the city of Jericho on the other side of the river, the plains of Moab east of the Jordan River. Something significant about that. And that's, by the way, that's also the vicinity of ancient Sodom. But this is why I think the demons will have some role to play, the spirits of the giants destroyed in the flood, at Armageddon. It will block the travelers. What does that mean? I think it means that when we are resurrected, that they will not be resurrected, that they have been condemned to wander the earth as spirits, denied access to the netherworld, Sheol, the proper place of their proper domain in heaven in the afterlife, or, you know, their, of course, their physical existence was ended by the flood of Noah. But in Isaiah chapter 26, he makes an interesting reference here, Isaiah prophesying a day when the dead would be resurrected. And he writes this in his Isaiah 26, beginning at verse 13. O Yahweh, our God, other lords besides you have ruled over us, but your name alone we bring to remembrance. They are dead. They will not live. They are shades, but in the Hebrew, the word is Rephaim. They are Rephaim. They will not arise. And then when you go to verse 19, it reads, your dead shall live. This is talking about the faithful. Your dead shall live. Their bodies shall rise. Resurrection. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy, for your dew is a dew of light. Now, this final sentence in Isaiah 26:19 is difficult to translate. The ESV reads it this way. And the earth will give birth to the dead. The earth will give birth to the Rephaim. But when you go to the Septuagint translation, it makes more sense, where it says that the land of the impious, or the land of the ungodly, will fall. And a scholar by the name of Brooke W. A. Pearson analyzed this and said this can only be a reference to the titans of Greek mythology, those who created the Nephilim, the sons of God from Genesis 6. They're in Tartarus. They're in the netherworld. They're punished in chains and gloomy darkness. He thinks that what Isaiah was referring to here, and has been translated, the meaning has been translated out of the text between the time of the Septuagint translation around 200 BC and the Masoretic Hebrew text on which our English Bible is based, which wasn't completed until about 900 AD, so about 1100 years later, that the ancient Greek or ancient Hebrew scholars in, say, 3rd century BC understood the connection between the sons of God in Genesis 6 and the titans of Greek mythology, both of whom were now banished to the netherworld. So what Isaiah is prophesying here is that a day is coming when we will be resurrected, but the travelers, the Rephaim, will not arise. They are dead. They will not live. They are Rephaim. They will not arise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy. That's us, the faithful in God. But the land of the impious, the land of the ungodly, will fall. I think what we're seeing there is a prophecy in Isaiah of the ultimate resurrection that Paul writes about in 1 Corinthians 15, when God raises us up at the last trump into bodies incorruptible. These entities who have been struggling along with their creators, the sons of God from Genesis chapter 6, and then this, the next wave of insurgents, if you will, or insurrectionists, the sons of God that God allotted to the nations after the Tower of Babel, to take dominion of the earth away from the children of Adam and Eve. That's what this whole war is about. Who has dominion over the earth? God created us to take dominion of the earth. Those spirits who, according to Jude, left their proper dwelling, they kept not their first estate. They were not created to have dominion over the earth. And yet they came here commingled with humanity. When you read Jude, when you read 2 Peter 2, it's clear that the sin of those angels that they were talking about was a sexual sin. I think that they were trying to create an army of hybrid humans to take dominion of the earth away from the fully human children of Adam and Eve.
Which is exactly what's going on right now.
And that's exactly through the transhumanist movement. And again, there's that hint of how that will play out for them if they should get what they want in overcoming death through science in Revelation 9. They will seek death, but death will flee from them. But that's why Jesus had to be fully divine and fully human. He has the right to come back as the king of the world, if you will, but also being fully divine. Only he, as fully divine and fully human, could fulfill the law and redeem us from the wages of sin, which is death. We were condemned by the rebellion of Adam and Eve. He's bought us back. He has redeemed us. And it could only have been done by one who was both fully human and yet fully divine. I don't think the fallen spirits who rebelled against him saw that coming, which is why I wrote the book Bad Moon Rising, by the way, Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, and I believe this is 1 Corinthians 2, if the archons, if the rulers of the age had understood the mystery that was being revealed through the apostles, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. They helped Jesus fulfill his mission by sending him to the cross. And then according to 1 Peter 3, he descended, proclaimed victory over the spirits in prison. Our friend Dr. Michael Heiser puts it this way, summarizing the conversation in Tartarus, hey, I bet you didn't expect to see me here, but here's a newsflash. At dawn of the third day, I'm getting out and you're still dead. And I don't think they saw that coming, which is why they had to adopt a plan B, which I believe was the creation of the religion of Muhammad. But that's for another story. So the concluding, just to summarize this whole thing, this rebellion that we're talking about, beginning in Genesis chapter 6, the rebellion of the sons of God led by an entity known as Shemiyazah. He was the chief of the watchers who rebelled on the summit of Mount Hermon, led this rebellion. Their goal was to create a hybrid king, a semi-human, semi-divine king to sit on the throne of earth, to take dominion of earth away from humanity. The impact was it corrupted the human bloodline, creating demons in the process. The spirits of those hybrid creatures destroyed in the flood also created the occult systems of the world that continue to this day. For this sin, this entity was banished to the abyss. The ancestor cults that we still see present in the world today, things like the Day of the Dead in Mexico, are traces of the echoes of this cult that goes back thousands and thousands of years. They also have promised a return to a golden age. The Roman poet Virgil, with his fourth eclogue, promising a return to a golden age when Saturn will return and rule with a new breed of men sent down from heaven. This taken as a prophecy by Freemasons and other occult adepts for centuries, and they're working to make this a reality. Again, as I mentioned in the very first episode, I don't think it's a coincidence that the World Economic Forum announced the plans for its Great Reset officially 1 month after the Great Conjunction of 2020, when Jupiter and Saturn met at 0 degrees of Aquarius, inaugurating the age of Aquarius, ruled by the planet Saturn, on the winter solstice of 2020. This entity, Shemiyazah, known by many names throughout the centuries, Kumarbi, El, Enlil, Dagon, Asher, Molech, Baal, Haman, Kronos, Saturn, but in the end times, he'll be called the Destroyer, Abaddon, or Apollyon, when he comes out of the abyss in Revelation chapter 9. But he only gets 5 months, and those who accept Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, we don't believe that we'll be here. We believe in a pre-tribulation rapture. We believe that the church will be out of here before this entity returns to earth. But since Revelation 9 says that there are those on the earth who will have the seal of God in their foreheads, there will be believers in this world when he returns. They will be protected through the horror when he literally brings hell on earth. People will be so in torment that they will pray, they will long to die, but they will not be able. What's fascinating about that is that death in Greek is thanatos. Thanatos, the Greek god of death, is the rider on the pale horse. The pale horse rider, Thanatos, will flee from these people as they are being tormented by Abaddon, Shemiyaza, and his colleagues when they come out of the abyss, out of Tartarus. But they only get 5 months, and then God puts an end to it. We will reign with Jesus Christ as co-heirs of this new kingdom. According to Paul, we will judge the angels, and we will join our Lord and Savior for life eternal in incorruptible bodies here on a new earth.
So where do the, this has always been a passage in the prophetic, prophesying texts. It's always puzzled me, is the people who remain that have the seal on their forehead. Are these people who chose Christ, repented, and after the raptures happen and the God takes away his church, and then there's those who said, oops, I should have done that, I'm so sorry. But if the mark of the beast has already come along, and that's the one unforgivable sin in the Bible, because it's complete insurrection against God and bowing to the satanic forces. That's always been confusing to me about how these people are still here, obviously left behind. Now they've got a seal on them that they're protected from this torture for 5 months, but why are they still here? Who are mm-hmm. they? Who are those people?
Well, Bible isn't explicit here, and so we have to do some speculating. Again, we think that we will be out of here, and I say we, I mean Sharon and me, and there are others who believe in a pre-tribulation rapture who would agree that these are the tribulation saints, those who accept Jesus Christ during the Great Tribulation, which will be exceedingly difficult because doing so means you refuse the mark of the beast, which means you're cut out of the economic system. You can't buy and sell, so you've got to find some other way to feed yourself and feed your families. It's going to be a very, very difficult time to be a Christian. But if we are wrong and the church is not removed from the earth prior to this period, then those of us who have accepted Jesus Christ and are still on the earth will be protected. So it could be one or the other. We think the evidence suggests that we'll be out of here early because of the prophecy of the 70 weeks given to Daniel, where 70 weeks have been decreed for your city and for your people, presumably meaning the Jews. And if, and again, this is based on assumptions, and if any of these assumptions is incorrect, then of course the whole model falls apart. But we believe that the 69 weeks referred to the time between the decree by Artaxerxes to rebuild the temple and the arrival of Jesus in Jerusalem. And there's a scholar by the name of Sir Robert Anderson who wrote a book called The Coming Prince back in 1915.
Wow.
That points to this. I mean, he was a remarkable man. Robert Anderson was one of the investigators on the Jack the Ripper murders. And so Sharon's working him in as a character in her Red Wing Saga series of novels. But he was also a theologian, and he believed firmly in the inerrancy of Scripture. And he actually wrote to the royal astronomer in Greenwich and said, okay, when was the new year in the year 440 BC? When did it begin? And say, hey, the astronomers look, and they didn't have Google to look this up back then. They had to consult the charts and slide rules. And so they calculated it to the day. And then based on a 360-day prophetic year, because the Hebrew calendar is made up of 30-day months, he calculated to the exact day the arrival of Jesus and showed that it was the arrival of Jesus in Jerusalem on Good Friday.
Wow.
It was to the day. So Anderson wrote this in 1915. And if that concluded the 69th week, and we're waiting for that 70th week, that seven-year period we call the Great Tribulation, if it's for your people, meaning the Jews, presumably that means the 70th week does not include the church. So that's one of the main reasons we believe the church is raptured out before that final 7-year period of horrors led by the Antichrist. But if we're wrong, well, okay, we're protected because we are sealed by God as believers in Jesus Christ. It won't be a fun time, but we will not have to endure the tortures that the people who refuse to repent and continue to curse God during that period of time.
Well, you know, I've listened to a lot of Bible eschatology discussions, and I've got, you know, several books, you know, in terms of, and there's lots of interpretations. I mean, there's several, you know, there's the pre-trib look, there's the mid-trib, you know, we go through the first 3.5 years of stuff, and then the Christ comes and takes us out, and then the reign of terror starts for the next 3.5 years until, you know, and then there's the, well, why should he take us out? Because we need to be here for the revival of those that want to be saved during this horrible period of time. And whenever it, and so, you know, and there's at least three distinct schools of thoughts on that. And I remember listening to, I don't remember who said this, but I co-opted it. They said, I don't know which one's right, but I know one of them is, you know?
So, yeah.
And so the whole idea really is not that, are we going to be here during this torturous period of time? What the real important thing is where we're going to be at the end of the day after it's all said and done. And right. Whether we die, you know, day after tomorrow, you know, God forbid, but, you know, we walk out the front of our house and get run over by a bus, or we're here through this torturous time, or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, you know, where our soul is going to be in terms of our relationship with Jesus and the Lord starts today and ends today, because we are not guaranteed our next breath. And Amen. so where all of this is great history, and it's the eschatology, for those that are listening, that word just means, you know, what is end time prophecy and where do you fall on that? Are you a pre-trib person or whatever, you know? And there's just a lot of discussion about it, because there are unknowns in the Bible. There are references. And I think what you've done, Derek, to be able to pull together all of these things from all the way from Genesis, all the way to Revelation, and pulling out Daniel and Ezekiel and all these texts, and then put it in context with archaeology. I mean, like real sticks, bricks and bones and shards of glass and pottery and stuff like that. Because I'm like you, I'm a bit of a history geek. I have to admit, not nearly as much as you. I do. That's why I've so enjoyed this series so much, is because when you put it in context, it's so important. And we talked about this in one of the other sessions when you were talking about the Huberites. Was that did I get the name right? That had the pits that they were from, like
the Hurrians.
Hurrians. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, the Hurrians. You know, you put that in context of how long ago that was. I mean, even when you said it was a 400-year period, well, stop for a second to the listeners. You know, the United States of America has only been around for 230 years.
Right.
You know,
and we think houses that are more than 100 years old are just ancient.
Oh, I know. I know. I remember President Trump said something about that when President Xi came over from China and they took him to Mount Vernon, some of the oldest places here in our country. And he's like going, yeah, well, okay. Because their dynasties go back thousands of years. It's like, okay, that just looks like something was built like last week in our country, you know?
Right.
So these timelines, though, are what's so important about making the Bible be real. That the consistency of that, of all the way through from the beginning of the Bible to, you know, Genesis 1 till the end of Revelation. And then you bring in all these ancillary historical documents that were written in the time, like the Sumerian texts and, you know, and things like that. We talked a little bit about the Book of Enoch, and we talked not very much, but a little bit about the Book of Jasher, and how those are just like additional texts that, you know, so many, I would say, purist Christians say are heretical. And why do you even read those? Because if it's not in the Bible, it doesn't count. Well, really? I mean, wouldn't you really, you know, if you had a roadmap and you had an extra set of books over here that was telling you as you're going down the highway what you were seeing along the way from a different viewpoint, would you say, oh, I'm not going to pay attention to that? That's not my map. So this is why I think that these discussions that we've decided to do on these Thursday night series with remarkable authors like yourself is so important, because it allows people who are, you know, people that, that come to my happy hours. I mean, I think for the most part are Christian. I think there's some that are maybe Jewish, and there's some that are a lot of Catholics, you know, but for the most part, we believe in the Lord Jesus and we believe in God and we believe in the life ever after, but there's a lot more richness. There's just richness to the biblical text when you put it in context of history and archaeology and what other people who were alive at that period of time were writing about. You know, I Absolutely. Just think it's just so amazing. So as we close out our final night here together, which again, I said at the beginning, it makes me sad because I'm getting so much out of these, which, you know, I really think it's really important. We have to give the Bitly link because I know that people that will read this book will want the rest of your books and all the rest of the history and everything you're doing. But before we close out with that, is there like a summarizing thing that you'd like to give to our listeners or watchers here as we've summed up these 4 weeks together?
Well, basically it's this, be not afraid, as Jesus said. We can look at the world around us and say, you know, the darkness is rising and how is God allowing this to happen? He created all of us, including the residents of the spirit realm with free will. The only way God could eliminate evil altogether would be to eliminate free will. And he did not create us to be little wind-up automatons incapable of making our own decisions. In the same way that we choose to have children, knowing that there's a day coming when that child is going to try to get away with something and tell you a story to try to get away with it. We love that child anyway and try to train them up and raise them up in the way they should go. God has done the same with us. Some of us have chosen to listen to his voice. None of us perfectly, though, as the Bible tells us. There is none righteous, no, not one. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. John wrote, if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. So we are not setting ourselves up as more righteous than anyone else. But we know that God, when we read the whole story, has gone to great lengths to bring us back into the family. Think of the parable of the prodigal son. It's not just about forgiveness. It's really a picture of what this whole supernatural war is about. He created us with free will. He gave us this wonderful inheritance called dominion of planet Earth. And we squandered it and wound up working for the swineherd. Our friend Timothy Alberino pointed this out. It's like, brilliant. We're working for the one who was in charge of the unclean animals. This is as low as we could possibly go. And yet, when we return to the Father through Jesus Christ, when we return to him and ask forgiveness, covered with pig slop and worse, he puts the signet ring on our hand. He puts a robe on us and he celebrates. And the older brother in that story, who questions the father's decision and is angry, the faithful angels. They're wondering, why is he going out of his way to bring us back into the family? It's because that's what all of this is about. It's what the sacrifice on the cross, the death and resurrection was about. Bringing us back into the family, restoring us to the divine council. This is our inheritance. He's giving it back to us through his own sacrifice. That's what all of this is about. So when we see what's happening in the world around us and we get afraid or angry, just remember Psalm chapter 2. Why do the nations rage and imagine a vain thing? The kings are plotting to burst asunder the cords that God has placed on them in their minds. But God looks down from his throne and laughs in derision. They think they're winning. The rulers of this world, the political rulers of this world, the spiritual, the principalities and powers behind them, behind the globalist agenda to bring us back to Babel. They think they're winning. God laughs in derision. And he says, as for me, I have set my anointed one on Zion, my holy hill. That's where all of this ends. That's what we're working toward. Our mission in the meantime, like the men of the West outside the gates of Mordor in the Lord of the Rings, we are to hold our ground until our Savior arrives at the head of that heavenly host. Share the hope that we have in Jesus Christ with our family members, our friends, our colleagues, with gentleness and respect. Bring the wounded off the battlefield behind our lines. Show the love of Christ even to those who are unlovely. And a day is coming when he will return and justice will return, not with old Saturn, but with the Messiah.
Amen. That was as good as a prayer. That was wonderful. Say, seriously, because that's exactly what we need to hear and to close with. So, Derek, thank you so much for the graciousness of your time and the generosity of the information. And I'm just going to say a couple words in closing that, you know, just a plug for our sponsors with MyPillow.com. If you're shopping over there, use our affiliate code DRT. And if you're going to buy supplements, please go to ShopTenPenny.com through the end of February. Anything that you buy in our supplement store, our private label supplements, or our apparel store is 15% off if you use the affiliate code Saturn. And Derek, tell them about your website and your book offers. And I don't know if this point in time, if you have any room left on your trip to Israel, but talk a little bit about that too as we close out.
Well, you can find all of the things that Sharon and I do at our website, gilberthouse.org. That's gilberthouse, one word, .org. There's a link there for travel where you can find out more about our upcoming tour of Israel. We've got a 2024 tour that's already in the works. We've got dates for that tour. We've not announced them yet, but we know what they are. We're also working on plans for a tour of Turkey in the fall, God willing. And our app gets you all of our content. We produce about 4 hours of content a week, our weekly Bible study, my weekly podcast, our weekly program Unraveling Revelation, where we talk about the end times, and our weekly podcast, PID Radio, where Sharon and I just talk about news of the week through a biblical lens. All of that is available on our app, along with a Bible app and much more, calendar of upcoming events. If you go to our store, which is there at the website as well, I'll give you the Bitly links for the second coming of Saturn. Bitly, that's bit.ly, bit.ly/secondSaturn takes you directly to the book. If you buy it from our store, I will sign it. And we've also got a bundle offer on all five of my nonfiction books, which basically cover everything from Genesis to Revelation. You can get those normally for $100, but with this link to the bundle, you get the 30% off. So just $70. It's bit.ly, bit.ly/Saturn30. And just check our store. We're always putting together bundles to try to get the information out there, and hopefully in an affordable way.
That's awesome. And I will say that if you missed the first three sessions of this, if you were, you know, asleep at the wheel, out of town, otherwise predisposed, all four of these wonderful sessions that we've had are available. If you go to drtenpenny.com/Saturn, it'll take you right to the page. It'll be lesson 1, 2, 3, 4. You can just listen. And if you have listened to these before, I think you can pretty well tell there's so much information here and it's so dense that you really do want to go back and listen to it again. And if you have the book, if you purchased the book to go along with it, as you're reading the book, because I've read the book, or honestly about 2/3 of the book. So now that I've listened to this, and now I go back and I started rereading the book this last week, the book made a lot more sense because I'm actually more of an auditory learner than a visual learner. And so to hear it and now read it and then go back and hear it again, now you'll really internalize it to where it really makes a lot of sense and you'll be able to share it with your family and friends. So I want to thank everybody for joining us here tonight, this week. This has been so good. And I think that we are going to be doing a few more series like this with some amazing authors that have said, yeah, I'd like to do this. It sounds like a lot of fun. It's a way to get the information out and share it with a lot of different people. So we will hope to see, we'll see you again here next Thursday night. Of course, on Monday mornings at 9 o'clock, this week with Dr. T is at 9 a.m. We're starting a Brighteon TV channel, and I believe that it starts next week. That will start at 7 o'clock on Monday nights. So I'll be doing that on Sunday, on Monday nights. Tuesday night is Happy Hour with Dr. T. Thursday night is Happy Hour with our guest series. And then we do Critically Thinking with Dr. T and Dr. P right after that. So, you know, I'm pretty busy too in terms of trying to get information and things out to people. So, and we really appreciate your support. So with that, I just want to close out by saying I close all of my podcasts, whether they're pre-recorded or if they are live, with Romans 12:12, rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until the next time, remember to lean into God, trust him for everything. He will never let you get down. Thank you again so much, Derek. And thank you for all of our listeners. Have a great rest of your week and a great weekend. Good night.